have a talk?
Yeah, we could.
Okay. I'll keep it as short as I can, I promise.
Alright.
Alright, wonderful. Okay, just see.
Okay.
As I said last week, I'm doing some research on the desegregation experience in Baltimore City, and I'm concentrating on the period before the Brown decision was handed down. So I'm looking at different avenues and different areas of life, education certainly being one of them. So I wanted to speak to you not just about your experiences of getting into the University of Maryland School of Nursing, but as much about your background, the neighborhood you came out of, and who were the people who made you the person that you were before you entered into the school. So I should mention that I am recording our conversation, and what I will do is at the conclusion, I'll get your address and I'll mail out the release form. In order for me to use this in our research, I have to have permission from the people that say, you have to know that I was recording and everything like that. Okay. Uh-huh. Is that right?
I think it was last year or year before last, I went out there, you know, for her presentation.
Uh-huh.
And at first she said, you know, you may make me nervous if you come in. I said, I don't know, I might be of help to you. I said, because if you get nervous, you can call on me. And I said, because I can talk freely. So they thought that I was a relative, you know, and I just sat on the side, and there were some other people before her to present, and then when she presented, she was playing a tape of us, and she had taken me to lunch, and she had done this tape, but then the tape was getting monotonous, so I was trying to give her a hard time to turn it off. So she caught it, you know, and she turned it off, and then she probably got a little flustered as to where to go from there, so then she turned, and she said to them, well, Ms. McCready is here. Would you like to? They were shocked. She said, can she speak? And they said, of course. So I told her afterwards, I said, I see, I told you. I might be of more help to you than you think.
What was her name? What's her name?
Huh?
What's the young lady's name?
Her name is Joy. Joy, I don't know. I haven't written down.
Okay. Yeah, I'd love to read it. I'd love to read her dissertation. Okay.
The dean knows who she is, too, because she had contacted him.
Okay.
You know, to contact me.
Well.
Yeah, so she did a big thing, you know, because she started out as, she was taking a course in women's studies, I mean, and she said she was looking, and she said, my name kept coming up, and she said, then she decided to do it. Then her advisor said, well, listen, why don't you carry this further? And do it, do your dissertation. And cause she had a grant for all this stuff. And that's what she did. You know, that's how she came about, you know, really going into getting all this material from every place.
Yeah, well, frankly, this is a conversation I wanted to have for some time. I first learned about your case when I was looking at the segregation of higher education in Maryland specifically. I graduated from College Park, and I did a master's degree at Morgan State University. And while I was there, I was helping them to try, they're beginning to pull together a more recent adaptation, a more scholarly adaptation of this school's history. So in the process of finding out how Morgan became a state school, I got introduced with the Murray case, and I followed the Murray case through all the other sort of processes, and it led me to individuals who were not only the first to be in the graduate school, but even a gentleman who was actually Hiram Whittle, the first undergraduate at College Park, and I got a chance to speak with him. Perrin was a graduate student.
Yeah, but Hiram did go to College Park.
Yes, he did, actually. He was down there for, I think he said a year and a half.
He was in the Boston
No, ma'am, I think you, I know that gentleman you're speaking of. The Hiram Whittle was...
Hiram Whittle, I know Hiram Whittle.
Okay. Oh, no, I didn't mean to insinuate that.
I know Hiram Whittle, but I thought he was in the School of Pharmacy down there.
He entered.
I was under the impression, the reason I'm saying this is because, did you see actual information that he was out at College Park?
Yes, ma'am. I came across his name from a front page story in the Afro before I actually spoke to him. Yeah, and the
because I was under the impression that, when they did the, Donald Murray had integrated the School of Law, you know.
Yes, ma'am.
But African Americans could only attend law school every evening. And then when my case came about, they had students applying for the School of Medicine, School of Pharmacy, and School of Dentistry. And that's where I thought Hiram was for the School of Pharmacy.
I have a list somewhere, and it would be too cumbersome for me to search it out right now.
No, but it would be interesting. I would love to read that.
Okay.
You know, I can even ask a dean.
No, certainly, no problem at all.
You know, because I know that the College Park was still segregated at that time. And it would be interesting to find out exactly what year that was.
I want to say 1951, but the trick was, Curly Bird was still following his policy of only letting one in at a time, so just because one went in didn't mean the next could follow him. They would have to go through the whole litigation process again.
Well, you see, that's why I'm saying that when my case came along, they dropped the law, the all the others, the pharmacy, the dental, and the medical. They dropped those. They didn't have to argue those in the case. And the two medical students came the very next year in 51. Plus three additional nursing students, but they managed to get them out of there, I mean, promptly. The medical students graduated, but the nursing students, because the dean was just horrendous.
Is that right?
But they managed to find some kind of way to get them out gradually, one by one. And so then no one else came in until I was ready to graduate, and a young lady came in then.
Well, I haven't spoken to Mr. Whittle since, I think it was 97 when I interviewed him, but he's right there in Baltimore, and I certainly can give you his... Is that right? I can give you his phone number if you like.
That's why I know him, But we have never talked, you know. That's why I was, not aware of that. We had never actually talked.
He went down, if I recall, and I promise I'll move ahead here. He went down, I think, if I recall the interview, he didn't get space on in the dorms his first semester because he was so late in coming in. So he lived with a black family near campus. But he says the next semester they found space for him, and, you know, he was living on campus with everybody else, and he didn't experience in terms of, you know, segregated facilities, and, you know, whatever everyone else was allowed to do, he was allowed to do. But again, you know, there weren't any others coming to College Park until after 54 when the bar was finally dropped in the undergraduate program. So, interesting. Okay, well, that's enough of that.
That's interesting. I'm glad I found that out.
Yeah, as an alumnus of the University of Maryland, all those things are just amazing to me, because by the time I got there in the mid to late 1980s, you know, all of that certainly, it was certainly remnants of things, but, you know, it certainly wasn't what it was for people. No, man. All right, well, why don't we start by having you give me a little background information, who your parents were, what neighborhood you grew up in, and if your parents weren't from Baltimore, when did they arrive in the city, things of that nature.
Now, I really don't know exactly, but my mother was from Darlington, South, born in Darlington, South Carolina, but raised in Philadelphia. And my father was born on the Eastern Shore, I think in Crisfield, Maryland. And I don't know when they came to Baltimore at all, but I know I grew up on the east side of Baltimore, on Dallas Street. In fact, I always tell them over at Johns Hopkins now that where part of their garage is where my house used to be. And it was like right around the corner from Dunbar. So I went to Dunbar Elementary and Dunbar Junior Senior High. And I grew up on a small block with a very, it was just a warm neighborhood. Everybody looked after each other. And that one block was so different from all the other streets around us, we felt. Because since it was a small block, everybody just, we just felt so close to each other. And it was, we were talking about it the other night. It was just one growing up. We were poor, and we were saying, we didn't know we were poor. We weren't comparing it with anyone else because we were just such a close-knit group of people. And everybody around us seemed to be in the same situation. So we always had everything we needed. So we did not consider ourselves poor, but we were poor. We got up and saw, looked back, we were poor. But as I said, because of all the love and the warmth, we grew up very comfortable. And that went to church in the neighborhood. That was a must. Went to Memorial Baptist Church. And it was located on Bond and Jefferson Street at that time. And then moved to Preston and Caroline Street. But,
what were your parents' names?
Excuse me?
What were your parents' names? What were the names?
John McCready and Elizabeth
McCready.
Had two brothers, Edward and John Al. Edward was excellent musician, piano, organ. And I remember as a little girl, he would have people come to the house to, you know, go over some music. And whenever the young people of the church had a program on certain Sundays, in fact, every Sunday, different people, you know, had charge of the program. And I can remember when my brother would have the program, it would be so packed because they knew various high school and college kids would be coming, and you know, the musicians, and that they would really have a good program. So, my other brother was Richard Seaman. I have one sister, my two brothers have passed, my mother and father have passed. I have one sister who is living, and nieces, nephews, grandnieces.
What did your parents do for a living?
My mother was a homemaker, housekeeper for a priest, and my father was a laborer.
Was the neighborhood on Dallas Street predominantly a working class neighborhood? Was it all black or was it interracial?
All black.
Okay.
White people who lived in the community, you know, maybe one or two families, you know, probably were unable to, they could not move, maybe they didn't have funds to move. They just stayed there the whole time. They were elderly people, you know, without children. There was one bar, I remember, in the area, the community, and they had this one daughter who grew up sort of like with me, and it was amazing. While she was younger, they would let her come around to my house, you know, all the time. And we would end up, you know, going shopping together down in the, down Gay Street, you know, the east side of Baltimore, Gay Street is. But all the shopping areas, that was the shopping area, and we would go down there, and I can remember she was blonde with long hair, and it, look at us as we were just going along, not even realizing anything. But as she got older, I noticed that she stopped coming around, you know, and I didn't bother to go looking for her either.
How did you come to understand, you know, looking back from this point in your life, how do you think you came to understand the sort of mores and the conventions of living in a Jim Crow society? In other words, did your mom sit you down and have a do's and don'ts talk about Jim Crow, or is it something you simply absorbed?
No, I think it was just absorbed because, you know, Baltimore was a previous town. that the buses weren't segregated. We didn't sit in the back of the bus in Baltimore. There were no black, of course, bus drivers. In fact, there were no black people who were clerks in the stores. But it was just something that you accepted because everything was there were no white people, as I said. There were no children growing up in the neighborhood, so there were no white children who were attending school nearby or anything like that. So I didn't know of, and that's why we couldn't compare anything because there was nothing to compare. Everybody was sort of in that area, and we did the same thing. It was just a working class area, and we just knew that there were certain places when it was downtown you could not go into the department stores and try on clothes. We knew that. They let us know that you couldn't try. If you went in there, they would say you can't try it on. You can buy it, but you can't try it on, nor can you bring it back. So that was stated to you if you went in the store, and that was up to you not to, you know, whether or not to buy something in a particular store where you couldn't try it on or bring it back.
Was that something that you had personal experience with or something that other people, in other words, did you?
I had personal experience.
Okay. All right. Is this something, like say, for example, you would go to Hustlers or wherever you might go with your mom? I guess I'm trying to, or the sister.
And if you, like, for instance, if my sister was going to buy something and say, it needed to be said, you couldn't try it on. At first, we didn't know it. We went into the store. We didn't know that you couldn't try it on. But then they, as I said, they let you know immediately that this was the policy of the store.
All right. Now, you said you went to Dunbar Elementary, Junior High, and Senior. Do you remember the number for Dunbar Elementary?
It was 101.
As a student going through elementary and junior, senior high school, did you ever have a sense that there was something you were missing on, if you were missing anything? In other words, was it the segregated experience where you just knew that there was something on the other side of the hill that you weren't getting, or did you have a positive experience?
Elementary straight through high school, because we had very dedicated teachers. We had teachers who seemed like they wanted us to get ahead.
Okay.
And that was from, as I said, elementary straight hardworking teachers, as far as I can remember, who really made sure you got a good education. And I marveled at the time. See, my whole thing is that I felt the Brown versus Board of Ed, that I felt that desegregation of the elementary school from elementary through high school was the worst thing that ever could have happened, because we had excellent teachers who were dedicated, and there was nobody. I can never remember any teacher goofing off, not doing her work or his work. I mean, they were on the ball all the time, you know, homework, checking it, checking this out. We had people who were interested in oratory, like I was. We had an oratorical society, and oratory society. And you did all this presentation of your music programs, like this debating club. And those who so it was just an event for Black History Week or Negro History Week. We always had we had Carter G. Woodson come. I can remember when I was sort of like in the ninth grade, I think. So we always had, you know, very interesting people. And now I remember that we did occasionally have interactions with, when I was in high school, interaction with white schools when we did, like, the debating side, when we had a debate on something, on occasion that happened. And then occasionally on certain days we would have I can't even remember whether what was the occasion when we would have Protestant Christians come to the school to speak. But I can remember that happening, like almost like every year at a certain time it would be a priest or a rabbi, somebody else. So I never felt that, never even thought about what was going on in white schools. Because, we just didn't have any association with them. And then I remember, we liked to go roller skating, but the rink was not open at one point for us. And then they decided to start having it on certain days for the black kids to come. And, of course, the ice rink never was desegregated.
What, do you remember the name of the skating rink, the roller skating rink? Okay, all right, fair enough. Now, how does it come about that you decide to make an application for admission to the nursing program at University of Maryland?
Well, it was, let me put it this way. I will always believe that I was chosen to do that. When I say chosen, I mean by God.
Okay.
Because as a little girl, I was always a loner. I could be alone and it didn't bother me. I could play alone with dolls. And every year I would, I got to be about 8 years old, I knew I wanted to be a nurse. Because at Johns Hopkins, if you were born in the hospital or delivered by one of their doctors at home, which that's what happened to me, they followed you until you were about 16 years old in their pediatric every year, getting a physical, all your shots of today. So it was this yearly visit to the hospital, and I would see the nurses, the doctors, And so early on, I decided I wanted to be a nurse. Somewhere along the way, like maybe ninth grade, I became fascinated with typewriter, and I decided that I would get out of the academic area of study and go into commercial because I wanted to be a medical stenographer. But it only took me a year and a half, I think, in commercial to realize that it really was what I was doing. And I had to then go to summer school for 2 years to pick up the academic courses that I had missed. And, to be thorough, to be fully back into the academic program at the school. And it might have been after a career day. I do remember in the classroom talking to other students. I think there were several of us who wanted to be nurses, and one of them had already applied to Providence because that was the only hospital where black students could go. And I said to them, it's a shame that we can't go to any school we want to go to. And they said, I know. And I said to one girl, why don't we write to some of the So she said, well, we know what they're going to say. I said, yeah, we know what they're going to say, but let's write anyway. And she said, well, what will we say? I said, well, I'll write down what I'm going to say, and you can base yours on that. I said, but the one thing we must remember to say is that we are Negroes. And so they will know that we're not trying to pull anything off. And I said, he said, well, which schools will we write to? I said, well, let's get the phone directory. And we found hospitals. I said, now you take half. So he took the first half, wrote down the names and addresses, and I took the second half. So the University of Maryland was in my group. So we sent off, to these schools, and then we started comparing them and laughing at their responses because some would flatly say, we don't accept Negroes. Others would say, we don't accept Negroes, but I can refer you to such a place, out of the state. And then one day I got this application from in the catalog from the University of Maryland. So I said to her, I have a catalog and an application blank from the university. Why don't you write to them? So she said, no, I'll wait and see what happens to you. So I had to take my application, the form for the medical part, to my family doctor and to my family dentist. So I went to the family doctor. He was shocked. He said, well, have you called the NAACP? And I said, what for? And he said, well, you know you're not going to get here without their help. Well, that was just foreign to me. I didn't even realize what he was talking about. And so I just didn't respond to it. And I guess he said, she is not going to do anything about this. And to this day, I don't know whether I'm almost sure he alerted them. But anyhow, I went to the dentist, who was a younger man. My doctor was Raina Brown, and Oris Walker was my dentist.
Dr. Brown's first name for me.
R-A-Y-N-O-R. And I went to the dentist, who was like a block away, for him to fill out his form. And I said to him, you know what he asked me? Did I contact you? No, LACT. And he said, you don't have to do that. Now, he was young, too. you don't have to do that. You can do it yourself. I said, yeah, that's what I'm thinking. So anyhow, he filled out his part, gave it to me, and I, got them. And I think I had to mail them all together. But anyhow, that's what happened.
Not to interrupt you, were these certificates of your health or this vouchers that you're...
No health.
Okay, all right.
Each one had to fill out the health form.
Gotcha, okay, sorry.
And then I would like to send these off. In fact, really, at the time you were using straight pens with the little bottle of ink. And I was filling out my application, had the bottle of ink on the stand, filling, writing, and I accidentally spilled the ink on the application. Oh my gosh, I thought I was going to yell. My mother and father came running down the steps and said, what's wrong? But my mother saw what had happened and said, oh, don't cry, don't cry. Just write for another one. But when I did write, I just said that, I had an accident. Application. I didn't say who I was or that I was a Negro this time at all. So they did send it within a couple of days since the application, and I completed it with the ink far away from me this time. And next thing I know, I was hearing from, I don't know how soon afterwards, that I heard from the NAACP just asking me to come in to talk with their lawyer, that they had heard that I had applied to the University of Maryland. And so I went in to talk to Donald Murray and, told him, asked me how this come about, and I told him. And then they wanted me to talk to their chief counsel from Washington. He came another time, and they wanted me to come talk with him. That was Charles Hamilton Houston. He really thoroughly interviewed me and said, it was almost like a cross-examination. He wanted to know who put me up to this. And I said, no one put me up to it. What do you mean? He said, who told you to do all of this? I said, nobody told me to do this. I mean, he really, really put me through it. And he saw that I could stand up to it. He said, you're very brave. And he said, well, since you did this all on your own, we'll let you continue doing it on your own, writing to them whenever you have to. He said, but only this time you send everything, certified letter, return receipt requested. And he said, this way they can't say they didn't hear from you. So then they let me go on, and so when I had wanted to go into the summer class of 49, August 49. And I don't remember exactly when I wrote to them, but it was in time for them to have gotten into that class. But as the time here, I kept, you know, I wrote to them and said, you know, I haven't heard anything whether or not I've been accepted. And please let me know if there's those things that have to be prepared before, you know, coming into school. And they would, you know, graciously answer it with saying that your credentials are being reviewed. And I would always send in return receipt, like the lawyer said, and I would let them know, you know, that I had written, and, you know, what it was about and what response I had received. So this went on. I think several letters I wrote, and several times they responded with the same thing, your credentials were being reviewed, until it got to be, you know, the time of August 49. And when they saw that the date passed, then Charlie Houston said, okay, they had no intention of admitting you. So we'll now take them to court. And so we went into the lower court of Maryland, and of course the judge was solely for them. They had, you know, Charlie Houston. Let me see now. They had sent one of their chief medical doctors down to Meharry. The Board of Regents felt that I could get a good education down there out of state, you know, expenses paid, and wanted to send me there. And they had sent their chief medical doctor down there, and he came back saying what a marvelous school it was. I could get this excellent education. So when Charlie Houston had him on the stand, he said, are you saying that Meharry is superior to the University of Maryland? And of course, you know, he was backing back on that, you know. I just mean, he said, well, you know, you're saying that she could go down to Tennessee, and anything that she could do in Maryland, she's supposed to be able to do in Tennessee, because she's really a little piece of Maryland down in Tennessee now. But he didn't know how to back out of that. Then when he put the dean on the stand, he asked her, Have there ever been any Negro students who have written to the university before? She said, slightly, no. He said, is it a policy that one has to state his race when to write to school? And she said, oh, no. He said that he wouldn't know whether he had written before or not. She got so, that bothered her so, that every time she would see me, once I got into the school, she would say, oh, that lawyer was so smart. Did you see how he questioned me? She would come up to me and say something like that. But anyhow, we lost, and Charlie Houston had a heart attack and was in treatment for one of the times. And I remember going to see him, and he said the strangest thing. Well, you are the last of the Mohicans. I said, oh, no, you're going to get out of here. They let me come in to see him, although he wasn't supposed to have any business. And I said, oh, you're going to get out of here. I said, and you'll be, you know, arguing other cases. He said, no, you're the last of the Mohicans. And so anyhow, when time came, he appealed. When time came for the appeal, of course, he was still in the hospital, and they called Thurgood down from New York. And we all went to Annapolis, and I just couldn't get over how those people worked, you know. He was looking at Charlie Houston in the court, you know. And then with Thurgood and Donald Murray, because Donald Murray was assisting Charlie Houston too. And then we got to the Court of Appeals, that was so interesting how they did it. The judges called on outside to start, and Donald Murray got up and spoke for about 15 minutes. Each side has about an hour. And so I remember when he presented and sat down, the judges said, you know, you have more time to serve as a guest. And so then Maryland's lawyer got up, and he talked, and they questioned him. And then his hour was up, and his servant got up and finished up. And you know, just said everything about, you know, why, you know, this is wrong, he denied, you know, admission to him. whatnot, but anyhow, you could almost see, you know, one judge was really not for us, but the others just feel that they were in accord with that strong. So anyhow, in April of 50, the decision was handed down at University of Mississippi. And when I remember the first day, my mother was so afraid for me to go. She wanted to know if I wanted to go with her. I wanted her to go with me, and I told her no. And Donna Murray came and said, you want me to go with you? I said, I can go by myself. I'll be fine. So anyhow, I went on, and not knowing what awaited me. And of course, when I got there, I found out, I mean, you could cut the tension with a knife. I remember stopping. It was like a gift shop at the beginning of the hospital at that time. And can you hold on a minute?
Certainly.
I, you know, asked directions to the School of Nursing, and they pointed the way, and I mean, everybody was waiting, you know, you could see everybody was waiting for this person to arrive. So I went to the School of Nursing, and I walked into the classroom, and I guess there were about maybe 60 students, and no one spoke. I went straight to the nurse in charge, and, you know, gave what I think he might have had to bring something with us, I'm not sure. Anyhow, she just said, all right, have a seat. And nobody said anything. Nobody, I mean, like their backs were almost like turned, you know, sure they weren't. Nobody said hi, nothing. And so we had orientation, so we were going, nobody came up, nobody said anything. I was walking alone, you know. And at one point, must have been some break, I was standing by the elevator, it might have been like after lunch, and I sat alone for everything, and even in the cafeteria, but I must say, the African-American people who were there working, oh, they were so proud, they were beaming, you know, and they called, you know, hi, how are you, and I'm very outgoing person, so you know I was glad to be seeing but I was standing by this elevator waiting to go, I guess, onto another area where we were supposed to be after lunch, I would imagine, and this nurse came up to me and said, if you don't pray to God, you won't get out of here because nobody here is for you. And I said, if God intends for me to get out of here, nobody here can stop me. And she just turned on her heels and went away, you know. But she was one who was kind the whole time I was there. She never taught me anything. In fact, I didn't even know what she did, but she didn't teach me anything. And there were times when, there was one doctor in one of the lectures would lecture to the side of the room where I was sitting. He would watch to see where I would sit. Then he would turn his whole body to lecture to the other side of the room. And I pointed it out to one student I felt I could halfway trust. And she said, oh, you're getting paranoid. I said, no, I'm not. So she watched that. She couldn't believe it. And they kept me out of the residence, pretending they didn't have any room. And of course, I've recently found out when I talk to students who talk to adults now who I work with at the museum sometimes, and they say, "What do you mean?" When I think they were listening to your tape and said that there was no room. She said they said there was plenty of room. I said, "I know that." And but you know, we were on a probationary period from September, I think, until February, and you had all these sciences that you had to pass. And after that, you were capped. And it was after I was capped that they had me come into the residence. Now, to justify this, they made all of the Baltimore students, which were, I guess, maybe three other Baltimore students, stay at home and gave us a stipend for traveling. And, but once the weather started changing, those kids loved it because they loved the money, they told me. But as the weather started changing and their parents started complaining, and see, they were gradually brought in, but I didn't know they were in. And as I said, I never got in there until I was capped. I mean, this team was really something. So, you know, there were still, by the time I left, there were still people in the class who never spoke. But the majority of them, you know, started coming around and gradually talking and whatnot. Sometimes you'd be on the floor working with them. But if two of us were ever put on the floor together, the white one would always be put in charge, always. So it was really a strange situation. And some of the instructors tried to give me a hard time, but I just knew I could do my work, and I just managed, you know, to get through it all.
At what point did you begin to naivete that you had earlier about just applying to a school and see, when did you start to feel like, you know, you were doing something, you know, unique, in other words, or
well,
bad?
You know what? Maybe I never really.
Okay.
I saw all the write-up. In fact, if my mother hadn't saved some things, if people had saved some things, because I would read it and just put it aside, just, you know, it was just nothing that I considered, you know, that I was doing anything different from anybody. No, I did not consider that. I just didn't realize, even though the lawyers were telling me, you know, how, you know, brave I was, but not, I just didn't see it as that. I saw it almost as a mission. And I don't even know if I saw it as a mission early on, but later on. And even, psychologists would say to me, "You must have some great inner strength to be able to withstand all that you have withstood." And but it was something. It was like when I don't know. My mother was such a wonderful person that if I was upset about anything, all I had to do was hear my mother's voice, and anything that was wrong just went away. She was that kind of a person. So whenever I felt, because there was one time when I was so thoroughly disgusted, I remember going to an Army recruitment place downtown. And so I think I had one more year. And I remember it was this white woman in this recruitment office. And so she said to me, you know, if I were you, I would complete that nursing because, you know, you come in on with a different rank when you're a registered nurse. So if you're interested in the service, I would complete that instead of coming out at this point. So there were moments when, you know, as I said, that were very trying. And there was one nurse who it seemed like her mission was to see if she could get me out of it. And she was one who when getting some of the others kicked out. But she tried with me. She wrote this letter to me, and I never saw that letter. all, the only thing I know the dean was saying that she had received this horrible letter. Well, the thing is, somebody had put an additional assignment up and didn't let me know about it after I'd already copied my assignment down. So I didn't give these 12 new medications because you were in and out and come on duty, you know, and take care of patients. You'd go to class, come back and finish up. And wasn't even the supervisor on my floor came and had me come in for a conference with her, and she was telling me how I had done such a terrible thing that I had not given these 12 new medications, and here these patients who were taking this medicine had a certain level of medication in the blood, and how, you know, now this level had dropped. And I looked at her and I said, now when they go to x-ray and various tests and the doctor stops the medication, what happens to the blood level? Does it say we're going to stay high because they're going for a test, or does it drop in? Ah, that made her so angry. That made her so angry that I guess this is why she wrote this letter to the dean. I don't know what she said on it, but somewhere along the way, you know, when you keep your ears open, and especially the people who work there, the black people, were always letting me know what they were hearing and all that. We don't get into any arguments with any of them because they're not talking to you at the time. But if you're listening, you know, fine, and letting me know, fine, but don't get yourself in any trouble by responding to what they're saying. Like, one is that I'm not going to ever call her Miss, and she was from one of the southern places, you know, because they don't get, the University of Maryland attracted many students from the South, Georgia, Mississippi, South Carolina, North Carolina, West Virginia. Most of them came from those areas.
Okay.
Very few were from, like, I think a couple in my class might have been from Pennsylvania. But most of them were from the Deep South, and it seems that way throughout the school, you know, of nursing. But anyway, they heard all kinds of people would come and tell me they heard all kinds of things, and it proved to be true what they heard. But somewhere along the way, I heard that the dean did not like this particular nurse who had written this.
Okay.
And I had heard it long ago from somebody. And when I went for my interview with the dean, who was thoroughly disgusted, didn't want to hear anything I had to say to justify what had happened, and something just came into mind to say that this, I didn't know why this nurse had come to talk to me because she wasn't the supervisor on the floor. And that hit something in the woman. She looked at me, she said, she wasn't the supervisor on the floor? I said, no, she wasn't. I said, it's the supervisor who was assigned to the and never said anything to me at all. That'll be all, he said. That, I never heard any more from that nurse again. She never bothered me with anything again. She was the one who, every time when I was going to be supervised for medicine, pouring of medicine, she came to do it and wouldn't be the supervisor on the floor. She took it upon herself to be the one. And I would always seem to be able to get her in some way, like every medicine that I was pulling out of Megan. And other students told me that this never happened to them. What effect did it have on the patient who was going to receive it? And I would be really fighting to remember pharmacologically what this medicine was used for, you know, and say, well, it was because of such and such a thing. And, pharmacologically, yes. And, then the phone rang at this particular day. The phone rang, and I was getting ready to pull down a medicine that I knew nothing about. And she went to answer the phone, and I said, okay, when she comes back, I will beat her to the draw on this. So when she came back, I said, now, I do not know this medicine at all. Can you tell me what it's for? We'll both look it up. Then after that, she never bothered me again on medication. But she was always trying to find something to do to be involved in with me, you know. So anyhow, but throughout the time, you know, I had to be challenging people about grades sometimes, you know, especially if these folks report on something. If I thought that I should have gotten a higher grade, I would challenge them and say, you know, why didn't I get this? And they could not justify. Some of them could not give me what I knew I deserved. And it was odd because there was a student in one of the other schools, a white guy, and he happened to have been new in town. Happened to be going to the church, the Catholic church where my mother worked, and the priest said to him one day that, he was talking to the priest, he said, you know, there's this Negro girl down at the university, that she walks with her head straight up, that she does not look at anybody, she just goes on about her way. He said, I'm telling you, she will never get what she deserves. And he said, the priest said to him, you know her mother. He said, I don't know any Negro people. He said, I'm from out of town. I don't know anybody here in this church. But he said, yes, you do know her mother. And he was shocked, you know, because they right away wanted you to have parents who were professionals. If you were doing something like this, did you say your mother is a teacher? I said, no, I didn't say that. Or, you know, so I just couldn't conceive that just hardworking people had a daughter who could come and face all of this and still keep her head on her head. And it was because my mother really was a strong woman who taught us all, you know, like you can anything that you set your mind to, but you have to set your goals and stay focused and not let anybody make you stray from it. And just know that if you work hard, you can achieve whatever you want to achieve. But she would always keep you humble by saying, never think you're better than anybody else, but don't ever let anybody make you think that they're better than you. And she said, know too that you're not the only one who can do something, that somebody else can do it and sometimes better than you. So she always made sure you stumbled, you know. So that's how I went through the school, you know, challenging this, that, the other. And then when I got to psychiatry, didn't know I was going to be going through the same thing because they had never had any black nurses at Springfield State Hospital where we had our psychiatric training. And of course, the director of nurses was a male nurse from Boston, and he called me into his office and told me that he had spoken with everybody, and if anybody looked like giving me a hard time, he would deal with them. And so I said to him, well, I don't, you know, expect to have any problems, but well, if you do, you let me know immediately. And it was so funny, there was a white girl in my class who would get a very deep tan. So she went to psychiatry like just before I did. And she came back and said, Esther, they thought I was you. And she said, I don't know, she's coming. And of course, there was an attendant, a great big woman, who said to me one day, you know, they asked me, why did you go to Crownsville? I said, who's asking? I don't know, people around here, not me. I said, well, tell whoever's asking, whenever the university sends their students to Crownsville, I'll be there. And since they're sending them to Springfield, I'm here. It wasn't me. I said, well, tell whoever told, whoever asked you, tell them what I said. So it was just things like this, you know, all throughout that you had to be dealing with little kinds of prejudices, but you know, I just would go on because I was so used to saying to myself, even in high school, after I had to change that course, it threw me off from my regular class. So a lot of times I was alone, even from them. So I would spend a lot of time in the library. So one day I was in the library down there, and I was so engrossed in whatever I was reading. And I heard all this commotion, and I looked up, and all of these white students were coming in, and I said, I wonder why they're here. I had transplanted. planted myself back to Dunbar. And I said, I wonder why I'm here. And then all of a sudden I said, I had to smile. And I said, oh, you're wondering why I'm here. So that's about the gist of it.
I can't
think of any particular thing other than what I've told you about the various little things that happened, because there were many. Oh, one big thing. I know this priest, another priest that my mother knew, he was the priest at Bon Secours, Father Sylvan. And he said to my mother, you know, she has gone through so much, I think she should be rewarded. And he said, I'm going to ask one of the doctors here, a very wealthy doctor, what can he do? So this doctor said that he would give me a 4-year scholarship to any university I wanted to attend, any place in the country, and all expenses paid, and I could come back home, I think, twice a year, you know, I think in addition to the summer. And so he was so happy, this priest was so happy about this, and he gave it to the dean. And the dean, one of the nurses told me that it was on the draft program for our big dinner reception and awards night. And the day of the affair, when the programs were printed, it had been deleted because it was the biggest award on there. And of course, he messed it up by telling me that they had wanted me to come to evening classes at the university. And I said, that's not what I heard. I said, I understood it could be any university in the country. Well, no, I think you ought to come here in the evening. I said, well, I'm not interested in coming in the evening and working during the day. And, well, you should try this first and then, you know, come full time. Well, I started, but I decided that I was not going to have her tell me how to do this, and it was not working out because I would get to class and I would be so tired in the evening. So I just dropped out, and I called the priest, and he was so hurt. He thought that he was doing the right thing by giving it to her. So he said, well, listen, I thought she would be the one to guide you right direction. He said, but I'll get the award, and go wherever you apply, wherever you want to apply. But by this time I was too annoyed, too disheartened, and I said no. So I told him that I was thinking about going into the service, and I would get, you know, further my education in the service. So he was really hurt, but I told him, you know, I appreciate what you did. And then I went to join to the Navy Nurse Corps. Wanted to get in the Navy Nurse Corps. Well, I went through all the business and going to Washington to go through all the ritual that you have to go through, you know, to get into the service. And when I got to the last doctor, he said, well, looks like you're in. I said, really? He said, yeah, everything looks fine to me. Well, I got a letter saying that I wasn't accepted because I wore glasses.
Oh my God.
And the very next year, see, they had their quota for that year. The very next year, they're going to write to me saying, well, we're writing to people who had just minor things, and, you know, asking you to come back. And I told them, no, thank you. So that's the climate that we, you know, were living in at that time. They had a quota system in the service, and they had quota system. I think even at the university, I think they had even a quota system. It was really weird. Now I think they control everything down there. But that's about the gist of it. I can't think of anything else dealing with university.
Just a few little things that you can clear up for me. When you say these African-American people working at the hospital, were these like maintenance folks or orderlies or?
Yeah. Or who worked in the cafeteria,
okay.
they were the ones who were, oh, they were just so baby when I came in there. But the maids, oh, they just, and the nurses, they, that's the only, and orderlies, and
wonderful
people, those were the only positions that they held.
Wonderful.
There were no graduate nurses of color.
Wonderful.
I think in my second year, they hired their first African-American graduate nurse. And I can't remember whether two were close together, so I don't remember whether the one who graduated from my school at the same time I did, but she had her training elsewhere out of the city of Jersey.
Okay.
I don't remember whether she was the first one. She might have been. But then there was another nurse from North Carolina. And I remember we were working, when you got to be in your second year, you were put on floors, you know, to handle at night by yourself or evening tour. So I was working the night tour, 11 to 7. And this nurse and I would, you know, take our break together. She was on another wing of the hospital. I was on one wing, she was on another wing. And we would go down for breakfast in the morning, and we would just talk and disbelieve. And I guess maybe about 3 weeks later, she said to me one day, we were coming, she was whispering it to me. She said, you know what? I would like to meet the one who first come down here. And I said, the first? She said, yeah, the student who was first. I'd love to meet her. And I said, it's me. She said, it's you. And it's funny because she said, oh, I just thought you would be, that person would be not down to earth. Isn't it amazing how we get these pictures? Because one of the maids said the same thing to me, that I can't believe that you are so down to earth. And I said, listen, I was brought up this way. And then when the three students came in behind me, she was pointing out to me how one, she said, now you see how you always talk to all of us? She said, they don't speak. She said, especially one of them, and she told me which one it was, she said, they don't even speak at all. And I said, well, you see, I just wasn't brought up that way. I would be speaking to everybody. And when the sometimes when the medical students came, sometimes, and that was Donald Stewart and Roderick Charles, they were the first two medical students to come. And Donald would come sometimes and have lunch with me. And it was funny, he would bring his sandwich, and I said, okay, now see, I didn't have to pay for food. They had to pay for, like, milk and dessert and stuff. And I would be busily going, we could have as much as we wanted. So I was busily going, I'm getting him milk. I think he'll get in trouble. I said, no, I'm not thinking about these things. So occasionally he would come, you know, and as I said, have lunch. But I would just usually sit by myself because there were times when I first got there, I would go and, you know, like the lunchroom would be crowded, and come in, and I had sat down at a table, like with, there was a white woman sitting. She immediately jumped up. And I just sat there and I said, oh, please, lady, please. Oh, my God. So there were so many things that people today, students today, can't even imagine. What went on for with people who paved the way.
Sure.
Donald Murray used to tell me how there was a guy who would always whistle Dogtown Strutters Ball when they were at the locker, you know, he would always be whistling this. I said, oh my God. I said, it's amazing how white people in their jealousy, I said, because I consider it jealousy. And I said, they go through all of these changes and they miss out on so much by acting this way. So I still hold that I think the youth of today would be in better shape had the schools been segregated. And if they had been segregated but equal, things like we had enough supplies and things at Dunbar. I don't know whether we did or not, but it seemed like we did. But it just seemed like when the schools integrated, all of the best teachers were taken out of the, you know, schools and put into these integrated schools. And then I think it left inexperienced teachers coming along to work with the kids who were left behind. And I think they were just disciplinarians. I don't know what happened. I just, and then a lot of the kids who went to the integrated subtle things were happening with them. You know, people telling them that they couldn't succeed. We never heard that at my school when I wrote that. You won't succeed, or you'll do nothing, or because you won't make anything of yourself, or anything like that. But I know students have said that, people have said that to them. And I've heard people on different shows say that they were told in these integrated schools that they wouldn't make anything of themselves, that nothing would happen, and they achieved and are doing well. So I just think that on a college level, you're older, old enough to sort of deal with it in a different way, that if you've had strong parents, strong teachers along the way, that by that time you have been shaped into something that a strong person yourself can deal with it differently. And then sometimes people can't deal with it even on that time.
Yeah, certainly.
And sometimes even like on jobs, people can't deal with it. So I guess it's hard to say. I know I was always trying to talk to my nieces and nephews and telling them, know that you're in these integrated schools and just work hard, do your own work. I said, and they're going to be asking you for your work. I said, they did it to me. I said, don't give them your work because they're not going to share with you. And I know my nieces come up with me, I didn't know they were so dumb. So I said, oh, you know, we weren't around them, so we didn't know how they were, you know. So I said, they could always give us a whole song and dance. My this nurse, student nurse, said to me, why is that so many Negro girls pregnant without being married? And I said, probably the same in your race. But I said, since they are coming to a white hospital, you know about this. I said, now if they all went to a black hospital, I said, you probably would never know. I said, and we don't know about how many of you come in that way. So it was always something that they're coming up with, some, you know, generalization or something. So, and then when I was out in Springfield, it was my last three months of work there. And one of the students said to me, oh, Esther, I want you to know that all of us stuck together because they were saying that the other nurses were going to wear the graduate cap. We had a student cap and a graduate cap. The graduate cap was called the Florence Nightingale or the Flossie, and they loved that cap down at the university. And so here they were coming saying that I wasn't going to join the Alumni Association because you had to be invited to that, and that I was not going to wear the graduate cap. Well, they didn't know that one of the black nurses they had said to me a long time ago, she said, oh, I'm saying that you weren't going to ever wear this cap. I said, don't answer them. I said, because if I graduate from this school, I'm going to wear the graduate cap. So when these students said this to me out there one night, we want you to know that we all stuck together. And I said, well, I'm glad you did, but tell me, cap would I be wearing? And you know, they didn't say anything. And that same big affair that I was telling you about, where the dinner dance, it was held, I think, at the Edmonds, like a hotel or something like that. Anyhow, I could not attend the dance because although they had a loud integrated meals there, of different functions dealing with programs with meals, they did not allow integrated dancing. So I was not allowed to attend, and when I called them, they said, your school knows our policy. And they still chose to have their affair here. So that's how that went. So it was something. I know Reverend Bascom has always said to me, why don't you write down these memoirs? I know I've given an oral history at the university, and I said, I try to, you know, remember. He said, you need to write this down. And the archives, Maryland Archives, had wanted to, they had said one time that they wanted to make these little history packets give to high school students, you know. But they have not followed through.
Is that right? I will check over. I actually work there now. I've been working there for the last 6 months.
Okay, well, someone had approached me, a few years ago. And they had said, you know, this is what we wanted to do. And it just never materialized.
I was definitely checking.
He was supposed to, he called somebody about it, maybe about a year ago. And they said they didn't know anything about it. I don't know.
Well, I was really checking. But a quick question. What block did you live on Dallas Street?
500.
The 500 block.
506.
506.
I see that number.
It registers
something.
Wonderful. Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time. I'm sorry I took an hour of your time.
Take an hour?
Okay.
Oh, it's so much about that place.
Well, wonderful. Yes, wonderful. You've been very, very helpful. I do have your address. It did occur to me as we were speaking that I do have it. So what I will do is get this release out to you sometime this week, and you read over it and everything. It's only like two lines. It just says you knew I was recording and taking notes. So I'll send a self-addressed stamp envelope with it so you can send it back to me.
Okay, and I must say this, that I feel that I've been very blessed because from all of this, I, you know, worked at so many different places. I worked in public health here for a while, then went to Massachusetts General in Boston and worked a little while, then to Cornell University, New York Hospital in New York, and worked, and then finally to Harlem Hospital. And in all of that, I did a undergraduate and graduate work in music. Music was always a part of my life. And then ended up teaching school for, I guess, about 17, 18 years. And two extra years, I taught Raven Simone on the Cosby Show. So, I mean,
The littlest child, correct?
The littlest one.
Yes, that's right, okay.
And then I ended up traveling with different groups to Europe and doing musical things. Community theater and television commercials and all that. So I really had a very interesting life.
Wonderful. So you said to me in our first conversation a few days ago that you're going back to New York. You're moving back there?
I live there, and I just came in today.
Okay.
And I'll be back up there on Saturday because I went up this past weekend because we had Women's Day at my church, which is Abyssinian Baptist Church.
Okay.
Out of Lake Powell.
Certainly.
Calvin Butts is minister there now. But they had Women's Day, and I hadn't gone for a couple of years, so I said, well, let me make sure I get up there.
Okay.
And then this week, they're doing Porgy and Bess at City Opera. Well, I had been in it a couple of times at the Metropolitan Opera, so I just wanted to sort of see what these people were doing. Well, it's going to be televised on public television on the 20th. I wanted to hear it in the house, so I put out word that I wanted somebody to round me up a free ticket. And then they have, at the Metropolitan Opera, they have this big opera, War and Peace, that I must see. I went to a lecture about it, but then I thought it wasn't going to sell, you know, and they said it's the best-selling thing they've had. So it's really sold out now, so I'm really worried whether or not I can get a ticket. So I'm going back to try and get into all of this stuff this weekend.
Wonderful.
I'll see what happens, and I'll be trotting back down here.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, good luck trying to get that ticket. if, you know, it's no rush getting the release back to me. Just whenever you can, it'll be fine. And
okay.
If I have have any other questions, I'll try to contact you, and, you know, if there's no hurry, so, you know, if I do need to talk to you again, you know, you can just, again, get back to me when you can.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
You have a wonderful evening.
All right, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Class at the end.